Monday morning you showed the fine. Good morning, NFL fans. Welcome to another episode of Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Another great episode for you today. We have a great lineup for the rest of the month to close out the 2014 season here on Monday Morning Huddle, Season 3. We have some great guests for you coming on to break down this playoff season. And we have two great ones to start out with on this show. So we're going to welcome in Cooper Allen. He's been on the show many times. Great guest. He's going to break down the Cardinals and Panthers game with me in a little bit. And we're also bringing on a new guest for the show, but he's not new at all to the Football Nation family. He's been a writer on the site for a long time, FN senior writer Doug Tozer. He's going to come on and help us break down the AFC, specifically Bengals and Colts, and then a little bit preview next week of Ravens versus Patriots. I'm going to break down the other two games on my own. We're going to start out with the most exciting game of the weekend, Cowboys and Lions. I'll also discuss Steelers-Ravens in our second segment. And then, as always, in our last segment, the third segment, we will get to our fourth and long part of the show where I ask, or not ask, but say three statements, and I either punt going for it and agreeing with the statement, or grunt and agree with the statement, or punting it away and disagreeing with the statement. So let's start out with what was the best game from the weekend, the best game so far of the 2015 playoffs. Happy New Year, by the way, to everybody. the Cowboys and Lions. This was a, is it too far to say, classic matchup? Going to go down as a classic playoff game. This was a really good playoff game. It had a little bit of everything. You had defense, you had offense at the end, you had clutch plays. But a lot of what's going to be talked about in this one are the penalties that were called on the field. They had such a big impact on the game. In the first half, the Cowboys had a really nice special teams play, a punt that put the Lions inside the 5-yard line. Actually, it put them at the 3-inch line, I think, because it was down at the 1, and then there was a penalty that put it half the distance to the goal, so it was even closer to the goal line, and the Lions were trying to punt from inside their 5-yard line, not picking up the first down. And running into the kicker penalty was called on Dallas, gave Detroit a first down. They marched down for a touchdown. That gives them a 14-0 lead and really put Dallas in the hole in this one. In the second half, especially in the fourth quarter, there were even worse calls, in my opinion, made by the referees. The running into the kicker penalty, borderline, I would say let it go, not call it. The Mike Pereira and Troy Aikman thought it was a penalty, so I just thought he didn't really run into the punter enough to get the call. They called it okay. You can kind of live with that one. In the fourth quarter, where Detroit on third down, they throw a pass to Brandon Pettigrew, and there was face guarding on the play. Now, face guarding is not a foul in the NFL. This is kind of a wide misconception in the NFL rules. Face guarding is not a penalty in the NFL. It is in college and high school, not in the NFL. What is a penalty, though, is if a defender is not playing the ball and makes contact with the wide receiver. So all you have to do as the offensive player is make an attempt to come back for the ball, run into the defender. You can run into the defender yourself, but because the defender is not playing the ball, not looking back behind his head for the ball, they're going to throw pass interference. That's why it's kind of a misconception that face guarding is a foul, is pass interference, because you see all the time the contact and the face guarding kind of go hand in hand. Face guarding by itself, however, is not a foul. On this case, in this case, there was contact. Pettigrew reached back for the ball. Contact was made. They threw the flag. It was the right call. All the announcers agreed that it was the right call. Would have given Detroit a first down. For whatever reason, they picked up the flag. I can't explain to you why. And it was a huge call in the game because it's fourth down. It was fourth and one. Detroit kept their offense on the field, appeared to go for it, trying to draw. They didn't go for it. They were just trying to draw Dallas offside, and then they took the delay of game and punted it away. But they gave Dallas the ball back with only a three-point deficit, and then two fouls on that drive extended that drive for Dallas. That was in the red zone, those fouls occurring. I believe one was a holding, and another one was an automatic first down for Dallas. Close in the red zone, getting close to the goal line. And then finally, Tony Romo finds Terrence Williams open on a kind of improvised route. Tony Romo running around back there, and Williams saw he was in trouble and just found an open area and was able to, Romo was able to find him in the end zone, and they got the touchdown, the winning score of the game. So as exciting as this one was, there's definitely going to be some controversy, particularly on that pass interference face guarding penalty. Again, face guarding because the contact was made, pass interference should have been called, and they threw the flag, looked like they got the call right, and then picked it up. And no one really can explain why. So that's another area that I'm going to talk about again in the fourth and long segment, the referees in this one. But let's talk about the actual play on the field and break that down. I was impressed that Detroit was able to keep up with Dallas. Based on the way Detroit played at the end of the season, the last 2 weeks in Chicago and in Green Bay, and this one being in Dallas, I wasn't sure this one was going to remain close. And Detroit had a great start. Troy Aikman said it himself. You hadn't seen Detroit play this well on both sides of the ball all season long. You've seen their defense play well at times, their offense play well at times, not at the same time. And everything was clicking for the Lions in the first half. Got to give Dallas a lot of credit. The broadcast on Fox, they continually said this. And Scott Linehan, it was his point that he made to the Fox broadcasters, that Dallas could not get one-dimensional. They had to continue to run the ball, even if they weren't having much success at it. Even down by more than 10 points in the second half, you had to keep running the ball on Detroit to keep them off balance and keep the Dallas Cowboy offense balanced. Murray, 19 carries, 75 yards, not a great average, didn't get 100 yards, did score a touchdown, got 18 of those yards on one run, so really sparse in terms of yardage on the other carries, but it was enough to keep Dallas balanced. Romo, 19 of 31, 293 yards, two touchdowns, pretty much mistake-free the entire game, did take six sacks, and that is really what kept this game close for Detroit. They won the battle up front, and that is what really surprised me. A lot of things from this weekend surprised me, but that in particular was one of the top things that surprised me, that Detroit was able to dominate the great offensive line from Dallas. Kept them from averaging, they averaged only 3.5 yards per rush, and they sacked Romo six times. For Detroit, they had pretty good offense at the beginning of the game, but it went stagnant in the second half. Stafford, 28 of 42, 323 yards, a touchdown and a pick. And ultimately, the Cowboys defense, a defense that has been widely criticized over the last 2 years, is one of the worst defenses in the league. They were on the field more than normal in terms of what they had been on the field this season. The time of possession was pretty even. Detroit had 29 and 33 seconds of time of possession, so basically even. So give the Cowboys a lot of credit on defense for remaining strong in the second half, despite being on the field more than they have been used to. And in terms of Dallas's offense, even though they had trouble up front, they had too many weapons on offense for Detroit to stop. The Lions, give them credit. They stopped Murray, held him under 4 yards per carry. They pretty much stopped Dez Bryant. He had only one big play in this one. As a whole in the game, Bryant, 3 catches, 48 yards. But they didn't stop Terrence Williams. He scored 2 of the touchdowns, the game-winning one, and he had the big play at the end of the first half to give Dallas some momentum going into halftime. Williams, 3 catches, 92 yards, 2 touchdowns. Don't forget Jason Witten. He led the team in receptions with 5 and 63 yards. So Dallas, really impressive. Didn't think it would be this close, but still impressive when you can win a playoff game, whether it's at home or not, whether it's against the Lions, the Cardinals. It doesn't really matter. Winning in the playoffs is very hard, and kudos to Dallas for getting it done. Their reward, go on the road and try to beat Green Bay, which is going to be a fantastic matchup because both teams are undefeated. What do I mean by that? Green Bay is undefeated at Lambeau this season. Dallas undefeated on the road this season. So something's got to give there. It's going to be a really exciting one. I'm not saying Dallas is going to win, but I would not be surprised if Dallas wins. I'm still taking Green Bay. I have not been right on many of these predictions yet in this postseason, though. So maybe it's a curse to take Green Bay for you Packer fans out there. Green Bay is still my choice. But not at all would I be surprised if Dallas is able to pull off the upset. They've been able to win everywhere they go on the road. They have the offensive line to do it. If they can run the ball and control the clock better than they did in this one, like they did all season long, keep Aaron Rodgers off the field, they have a real, they have a good chance of upsetting the Green Bay Packers. We're going to go now to our interview with Cooper Allen. I talked to him a little bit earlier this weekend about the Cardinals and Panthers game. We'll bring that interview to you now. We're now going to welcome in FN senior writer Cooper Allen, great friend of this show. Cooper, thanks so much for coming on today.
Not a problem, Dave. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Cooper is going to help us recap the first playoff game of the weekend, first playoff game of the brand new year, 2015. First playoff game also on ESPN. Arizona Cardinals taking on the Carolina Panthers. You know, in many ways, it seemed like neither team wanted this one. There were a lot of mistakes. I guess maybe you were expecting that, a team that was below 500 in the season and a team down to their third-string quarterback, backup running back, a lot of injuries they're dealing with. So there were a lot of mistakes, especially on special teams. But I want to start with the winning quarterback and Cam Newton. He has gone through a lot this season. If you remember back to the preseason, rib injury, a shoulder issue, ankle, car accident 2 weeks ago, able to come back and play last week and then win this playoff game. How do you feel like he played in this game, Cooper?
There's a lot of positives that can be taken from this game for him. First playoff win is big from any quarterback, and it's a big weight off your shoulders. But I don't really think that he had a role in winning this football game. There were several times where he had receivers wide open, and he just missed throws. And the Cardinals' defense, despite all the injuries that they faced, a lot of them were able to get pressure to Newton and hit him a few times, and you could tell he was hurting down in the third and the fourth quarter. And it was if he would have taken another hard hit or two, he might have been out of the game because he really was hurting. And that can't really be an excuse for the poor throws either, because a lot of them did come early in the game when the game was still close. And he played his part. He did what he could to keep the Cardinals in this game when they had no business being in it.
Yeah, one thing I don't particularly like about Newton's game is what you hit upon with his demeanor after getting hit a couple of times. You can't kind of mope around like he does after you take a hit or two. Especially if you're a running quarterback, you're going to get hit a lot.
And not only did he get hit and kind of mope around, like you mentioned, he turned the ball over twice, lost a fumble, threw an interception that got the Cardinals back into the game, set up their first touchdown. So I agree with you. I as positive as this performance was for Newton, I can't say that this is a guy that I think can make a really deep playoff run, at least this year, because of his health and because of still his poor decision-making and poor throws he's having to wide-open receivers.
Yeah, exactly. And threw the ball 32 times and completed 18 passes, 56% completion percentage. When you factor in that a few of them were just little dump-offs out of the backfield, and the rest of it pretty much was just running the ball, the Panthers' running game was able to have a ton of success. So the Cardinals started biting on that, and he had open receivers. He just couldn't hit them. You cannot complete 56% of your passes in the playoffs and try to be considered an elite quarterback or a top 10 quarterback. He's a first round pick for a reason. There's a ton of hype around him, and I don't get it. I did say it was a big playoff win, but it's not really for his sake. People are going to say this offseason, yeah, Cam Newton finally won a playoff game, but to me, he's no better than some of the other guys in the league. I think you got guys like Matthew Stafford. Even Jay Cutler receives a lot of bad credit, but Newton hasn't really done much more than he has.
You mentioned 32 pass attempts for Newton, only 198 yards, so that's a 6.2 yards per attempt average. Two touchdowns and the one pick that I mentioned along with the fumble. You mentioned as well about the running game for the Panthers as a team, 41 rushes, 188 yards, so they were getting 4.6 yards per clip per run. A lot of missed tackles from the Arizona defense, which contributed to that. And if you want to throw in the fact that one of Newton's touchdowns passing was a little screen dump off, that might as well go down as a run. It was all Fozzie Whitaker, 39-yard screen pass run for a touchdown, and that really opened things up. Your thoughts on the Panthers' running attack, and can they continue to play this style and win and perhaps make a run to the Super Bowl?
I don't think they can make a run to the Super Bowl, but I think what Jonathan Stewart has been able to do in the second half of this season for this team has been what's able to get them in the playoffs despite their 7-8-1 record. They're able to win their last four games and now on a 5-game winning streak. I think the way their schedule was broken down really helped them. They were one of two teams who had a week 12 bye, so a bye that late in the season I think really assisted them in being able to be much healthier than other teams down the stretch. And Jonathan Stewart, he really needed that extra week off. And in the previous 2 weeks before the bye, he had, between two games, 18 carries for 60 yards. And since then, he's had two games of well over 100 yards, another 85 yards in another game, 75 yards in another game. And then he comes into the playoffs and has a monster game against Arizona, who historically has been a pretty good run defense.
Yeah, I thought that Arizona would play a lot better on defense. And not that they played bad, but I thought they were going to be able to bottle up the Carolina running attack and turn the Panthers into a passing team, and then Newton would really struggle like he did. But the running game bailed him out, and that's really what won this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And defensively for Arizona, it was frustrating for that team, and they really underperformed versus the way they were playing earlier in the year. Speaking of schedule, talking about the Panthers week 12 bye week, the Arizona Cardinals bye week was in week 4. So maybe a little bit had to contribute to stamina. They've been on the field a lot the past 2 weeks with Ryan Lindley, quarterback, and it's starting to catch up to them.
24 carries, 123 yards for Stewart, for those keeping track at home. 5.1 yards per carry and the touchdown. Newton also rushed for over 5 yards per carry, 7 rushes for 35 yards. The longest run of the – or actually the longest play of the day was the one I brought up a little bit earlier, Whitaker's little screen catch that went for a touchdown. So that really sums it up right there, that a 39-yard play was the longest of the day. Let's go to Carolina's side. Now, I know everyone wants to talk about the quarterback situation and make the excuse that Ryan Lindley was the starter. It was the second lowest yardage total for a offense in a playoff game, lowest in the Super Bowl era. But it's hard not to look at the special teams of Arizona. Drew Butler, the punter for the Cardinals, had 9 punts, averaged 34.8 per punt. One of his punts was 52 yards. I think it rolled for 52 yards, didn't go in the air 52 yards. And his average was 34. So think about how low the other ones were to bring that average all the way down after getting one to roll for 52. And then talk about Ted Ginn, their returner. Right after Whitaker scored his touchdown, Carolina retook the lead. He has the costly fumble on the kickoff return, and Carolina set up, what, first and goal. And that was really what led to the end of the game in terms of Carolina scoring again, and the lead was too big for the Cardinals really to come back.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. There was, you look at the touchdown scored after the Ted Ginn fumble. You take those 7 points off the board, it's a one-score game throughout the entire fourth quarter, which completely changes the complexity of everything, the play calling, the momentum on both sides of the ball. So that was obviously a huge play. Drew Butler, it was tough to watch. Even for me as an Arizona fan, but for fans and writers and analysts alike trying to watch the game, if you weren't a Panthers fan, it was tough to watch. And I didn't understand it. I really didn't. I get that it was raining, but you can't have that as an excuse as an NFL punter. He had punts that I kicked balls further than that and just played out the backyard. It was bad. That 52-yard punt that you alluded to, the returner moved out of the way instead of calling a fair catch, and it rolled probably 10, 15 yards before it was down. So his numbers were inflated by that, and there was just a lot of ugly punts, which led to some great field position for Carolina.
It did lead to one great play where that punt returner you're talking about, Burson, for the Panthers, ended up muffing a punt, and which set up a Arizona score. But other than that, you're right. It was just a horrible day punting, and that was just kind of fortunate luck but that Burson just ran into a bad punt.
Yeah, Burson was another guy on special teams at a tough game. I haven't seen him much with the Panthers all year long, so I'm not sure if he's like that normally or not, but he seemed confused out there.
Yeah.
And in a game where every little momentum swing mattered, it seemed like every time the Cardinals would put a punt, there was always some sort of hope for the fan base, thinking that this guy might fumble it or let it go and we'd get some better field position because the guy didn't really know what he was doing.
Yeah, I think John Gruden said it well towards the end of the game. It seemed like the only nervous part that Carolina had to feel was fielding punts.
Yeah, it was bad all around. And like I said earlier, it's a game Arizona had no business being in. But when you look at Carolina's record, how they really had no business being in this game either. It's neither of these two teams look like they wanted to win on Saturday, and it's a shame that was the game that had to kick off the postseason.
78 total yards, by the way, for the Arizona Cardinals, if you wanted to the exact number. And one other special teams blunder I want to bring up, a little bit more typical in terms of mistakes. Graham Gano, the kicker for the Panthers, missed a field goal. So we just had everything happen on special teams in this first playoff game. And looking forward for Carolina, we don't know yet as of this recording who they're going to play, but I don't see them going up to Seattle and beating Seattle at their own game, because Seattle does everything that Carolina does, but better. They run the ball, but they've consistently run it better this season. They play defense, although Carolina's playing very well. Seattle has played even better, more consistently through the season on defense, and their quarterback is better. So I'm not sure you can put Carolina even in that game. It might be a blowout. And Green Bay, if they end up playing them, if Detroit wins that second NFC game and Carolina goes to Green Bay, that could be interesting just because we have a passing team versus a defensive running team. But again, do you really think this defense is going to stack up against Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay?
Not a chance. And we saw what Luke Kuechly was able to do. He is one great player at the linebacker position, but he made a couple of nice plays because he was able to read Ryan Lindley. It's Ryan Lindley. if you're one of the better players in the game, you're supposed to be able to read Ryan Lindley. So when you come in, you get a guy like Aaron Rodgers, who's fantastic at making disguises and making big plays. Kuechly might not have the same success. And if Kuechly doesn't make those two plays for Carolina's defense, it's a totally different ballgame. And they may give up 21 points to an offense that's featuring a third-string quarterback and a bunch of no-name running backs. So it doesn't look good for them moving forward. Green Bay is too good of an offense. Seattle has too good of a quarterback and too good of a defense. I don't see the Panthers winning another game this year.
Kuechly had one of those two interceptions on Lindley, and then the second one was tipped up by Kuechly, and that was right after the Cam Newton fumble that gave Arizona great field position. You thought maybe this was their chance to get back into the game, and on, I think it was the second play after the interception, Trey Boston ended up with the pick because of the tip from his linebacker. We're talking Cardinals-Panthers with FN senior writer Cooper Allen. Cooper, I want to ask you one other question. Back to the Arizona side and looking forward for them, a big question that everybody really wants to know is Larry Fitzgerald. He's been I don't know a lot about Cardinals history, but he's got to be a top five, top three player in that franchise's history. And if not, maybe the best. Only three catches for 31 yards in this game. Was this his last game with the Arizona Cardinals?
I think it could be, Dave. And we've seen the last two seasons. He signed back in 2011 a 7-year, $113 million contract extension. A lot of it was bonuses and dead money. But he has restructured a couple times. And I don't know if both him and management side are going to be able to come down to a number that they believe is right to keep Fitzgerald in Arizona. Right now, as it stands, he'll be a $23.6 million cap hit next year, with $14.4 million of that money dead space, according to SpotTrack. So, I don't know if they'll keep him around.
That's a lot of money going to one guy.
Yeah, exactly. And I could see them trying to trade him. I don't want to outright release him because if there's no one interested in him, then I feel like you got to just keep him on the roster because that's a lot of dead money just to be giving up to get rid of him versus the money that it would cost to keep him. But if they're able to trade him and able to get a couple of early draft picks for him, I consider it. As tough as that is to say, it's something you have to do from a business perspective. Fitzgerald's a great player and has been for this franchise since he joined the team. But it's a financial battle. It really is. They have Antonio Cromartie. They got to re-sign him. He had a fantastic season and was arguably a better corner than Patrick Peterson was this season. So he's going to want money. We saw Carlos Dansby last offseason leave this team for a bigger contract with the Cleveland Browns. And the Cardinals were hurting at inside linebacker all year long. So they need the funds to bring back players. They need the funds to go out and get players. There's a lot of question marks with this team moving forward. they do have a bright future, a couple of good strong seasons in a row, a lot of young talent with the team, but there are still holes that need to be filled, and you can't fill those holes without money. They only have so many draft picks,
right,
and only so many players can step up in their first couple of years.
With Fitzgerald, is it just a money issue? I've also heard from, you know, a couple of people that he doesn't like his new role on the team. Wasn't as involved on the offense this season with Bruce Arians in his second year. Is that also an issue, or is this just money?
I wouldn't be able to give you a 100% for sure answer on that one. But to my understanding, I have not heard once in all the press conferences and things like that that I've heard, I've never heard it once come out of Larry Fitzgerald's mouth that he isn't happy.
Okay.
A lot of that talk that came from his father and his brother. The two of them like to stir up a lot of drama. Larry Fitzgerald Sr.'s in the reporting business and certainly has a lot to say about his son. When things don't go Fitzgerald's way, or when he thinks things don't go Fitzgerald's way, he'll be the first person to speak out against the team, which is detrimental to the team, but not that dad cares. Fitzgerald, even at one point, might have been last year, a couple of years ago, had to go out to the media and say that his dad's views don't represent his views all the time and to take them with a grain of salt. So it doesn't help for his family stir in these rumors. And for, it's got to be tough for a guy like Larry, who, even if he is frustrated, he doesn't want the media to know about that. That's a problem that goes on between the coach and him, or the general manager and him. Because he's an all-class guy. He really is. He's never been the one to try and start problems in Arizona. He's been with this team through many years of bad quarterback play. And if he's not happy with his role, he certainly wouldn't be the one to go out and start media drama like his father or his brother would.
Well, I really enjoyed watching the Arizona Cardinals this season. They were a fun team to watch. I know a lot of people doubted them all the way to the end. I picked them, and I know it was a kind of a leap of faith to pick them in the playoff game. And I didn't have a rooting interest in it, but they were just a very likable team this year, and I think we all wish them the best going forward.
Yeah, this was certainly a big year for this team, and as you mentioned, a lot of doubters. But what they were able to do, what Palmer was in 6-0 with him starting, and even 5-3 with Drew Stanton in, they really turned a lot of heads this year, and a lot of positive support for this team moving forward. And we appreciate, this fan base appreciates the kind of words, Steve, and all the support.
That's all we got with Cooper Allen. Check out his stuff on Football Nation. He writes great things about the Cardinals and every other team around the NFL, and he always has great stories in the offseason. So definitely keep Cooper Allen on your docket this coming spring and summer and for the 2015 season. Cooper, thanks so much for coming on today's show.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Enjoy the playoffs.
Once again, that was FN senior writer Cooper Allen. Thanks for coming on the show, Cooper. You can follow him on Twitter at CooperAllen47. You can send me a tweet at DM, HOLCOMB, or send me an email at HolcombMDavid. Well, there's no at symbol at the beginning of my email. HolcombMDavid@gmail.com. A little confusing there. We got to take our first break here on the show, but when we come back, we will go to the AFC side of the playoff picture and break down the two games from this weekend. And we're back here on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle, your host, Dave Holcomb. Don't forget, I want to hear from you guys. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, HolcombMDavid@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. We're flipping over to the AFC side of the playoff picture now. We will get to our interview with Doug Tozer from earlier this weekend in a little bit. First, talking Steelers, Ravens, most exciting matchup going into wildcard weekend. Probably left you with the biggest dud, although, like Cooper and I talked, at Cardinals and Panthers wasn't exactly thrilling, but the way the Steelers played was just very disappointing, unless you're a Ravens fan. And if you're a Ravens fan, you're extremely happy with the way Baltimore played because they really outplayed Pittsburgh in this one. I know everyone is going to want to talk about Le'Veon Bell and him not playing. And, of course, that's a big deal. The best offensive player on Pittsburgh, the team MVP. Would this have been different if he played? It's hard to say no. So, yes, it would have been different in the sense that maybe it would have been a little closer. But the way Baltimore played, I do not want to take anything away from the Ravens. They completely dominated this game. And if you read my playoff preview, I said, like I talked about in that last segment with Cooper, the key to the Panthers and Cardinals game was Carolina running the ball. And they ran the ball. I didn't think they would, but they did. That's why they won. In this one, the key to the game was pressure on Ben Roethlisberger. If Pittsburgh could block up front and give him enough time to find open receivers, and there should have been plenty of open receivers because the Ravens had five defensive backs on IR, then Pittsburgh could run away with this game. None of that happened. They didn't get good protection on Ben, and when there was protection, nobody was open. And you can talk all you want. Well, Baltimore, they didn't have to stop the run, so they had extra guys in coverage helping out on Antonio Brown and other receivers from the Steelers. Look, you got a future Hall of Fame quarterback in Roethlisberger. You have a MVP-type guy in Antonio Brown. You have a great receiving tight end in Heath Miller. Marcus Wheaton, Martavis Bryant, young receivers, but tall targets, fast guys, should be that those four guys with a Hall of Fame quarterback should have been enough to win this game. And you can talk all you want about the Steelers' defense not playing that well. They didn't play all that well, but the only touchdown that they scored was set up by a turnover the Steelers' defense got for them. It looked like that turnover might turn the tide of the game, but then on the last three offensive possessions for Pittsburgh, all three were turnovers. That's not going to win many games. Yeah, and it just, at halftime, it seemed like Mike Tomlin was being completely delusional and John Harbaugh and his coaching was completely on point. We didn't see the interviews with each coach, but Michelle Tafoya, the sideline reporter for NBC, she reiterated what each coach said to her. And Mike Tomlin was saying, we're in a slugfest. We got to get some splash plays. We'll break through. It just seemed like Tomlin was acting like field goals would win the game and was acting like maybe this was a Steelers-Ravens game from 5 or 6 years ago. Meanwhile, John Harbaugh goes and says to Michelle Tafoya, field goals aren't going to beat us. It was just the ideology of each coach seemed completely opposite, and Tomlin's idea of where the Steelers were in terms of his team seemed to be taking a DeLorean back in time. This is a offensive first Steelers team, and they cannot settle for field goals and win this game. And that's what they did, and that's why they didn't win. Credit Baltimore, though. Baltimore's defense covered guys like Antonio Brown, Heath Miller, and all the other guys down the field. I don't care if they didn't really have a running game to worry about. They took care of those playmakers and got pressure on Roethlisberger, something that a team hasn't done in over a month. And it would it have helped if Bell played? Yes, because maybe that threat in the running game would have offset some of the pass rush. Maybe Bell could have helped in blocking some of the pass rush. Maybe Bell would have helped catching the ball in the flat and relieving some of the pressure for Roethlisberger. One of the turnovers was a tipped ball by Ben Tate. Bell probably makes that catch. But to say that the Steelers win this game if Bell plays, I think is furthest from the truth. Joe Flacco, don't think he's the best quarterback in the league, John Harbaugh, if you're listening to the show. But Flacco has really turned it on in his last, four or five playoff games. The beginning of his career was like, it was Andy Dalton-like, and now he has turned into a really clutch quarterback. Two touchdowns, no picks for him. Very efficient. He didn't get all the yards. Pittsburgh actually outgained Baltimore in this game, but they were efficient in the red area. They stopped Pittsburgh in the red area, and they scored in the red area. That is what wins in January. We're going to talk about the Bengals and Colts game now, going to our interview with Doug Tozer.
We're now going to welcome on a brand new guest that we've never had on the show before, FN senior writer Doug Tozer. How you doing, Doug?
I'm doing good. How's it you, Dave?
Very good. Thanks for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
Doug's going to help us break down the other AFC game, the Bengals and Colts. This was a interesting matchup. Both teams came into this game having blown each other out in the last matchup at home, with the Bengals playing the Colts and blowing them out last year in Cincinnati, the Colts shutting out the Bengals back in October in Indianapolis. This one in Indianapolis, and the Colts winning 26-10. Offensively, for Andrew Luck and the Colts, they threw short a lot in this game. Are you surprised at all at the offensive attack that Indianapolis had?
No, not really, Dave. I think what I noticed, actually, was that they only needed the long pass in certain situations. And you can see from the stats that Luck was able to do that. He had passes of 30 yards to T.Y. Hilton. He had a 45-yarder to Hakeem Nicks later in the game. He had the 36-yard touchdown to Moncrief. So, I mean, he used it when he needed it, but I think what he and Pagano put together was more of kind of a game management where the short pass and the running game kind of dominated the Bengals defense and did just enough to score what they needed to score.
Yeah, the Colts threw 44 times, Andrew Luck completing 31 of those passes for 376 yards. Dan Heron, 12 carries. As a team, the Colts had 25 carries for 114 yards, so a very good average, and Heron did have a rushing touchdown. And great points with the long passing game of Hilton and Nix and Moncrief all had 30-plus yard catches.
Well, what I thought was pretty interesting was that the Bengals weren't able to run the ball, or at least didn't attempt it as much as the Colts did. So that kind of, I think, contributed to a big difference in what the offenses were able to do.
Yeah, what do you think the Colts on defense were able to do to slow down that Bengals running attack? In the first quarter, Cincinnati was running the ball very well, over 60 yards of their rushing. Of their rushing yards came in the first quarter and about 50 or even less than that in the other three quarters combined.
Well, I think it kind of goes hand in hand with not having your number one receiver. And so the Colts were able to concentrate more on the run. And as the game went along, they kind of forced Dalton's hand by shutting that down. And that kind of left Dalton with nothing else to do.
I know it's kind of a hypothetical, and it's not really fair to the Colts because they won this game, but do you see it all being different if A.J. Green plays in this game?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure Dalton would have found some way to self-destruct, but in the end, he didn't have the weapons he needed, and that kind of hurt him.
So does this kind of give Dalton an excuse? I mean, it seems like every year he has an excuse, though, and he's now 0-4 in the playoffs. He's 3-11 in primetime or playoff games. Got a big win 2 weeks ago against the Broncos to get into the playoffs. But can this be blamed on Dalton, or is it the A.J. Green injury and other issues that the Bengals had that contributed to this loss?
Well, probably a lot of things. When you look at it, yeah, Dalton's 0-4, and I didn't hear his post-game press conference, but I'm pretty sure there's something in there about not having anybody to throw to. But
you know, in the end, I honestly don't think that he's a top-tier quarterback in the NFL, and his career will probably be short because of it.
It was 18 of 35, 155 yards, so that's just a 4.4 yards per attempt average. No touchdowns, no interceptions, got sacked three times.
Yeah, that not good stats at all. I mean, that's not what you see from the good quarterbacks. You're not going to see, hardly ever would see a game like that from a Tom Brady or a Peyton Manning, but this seems to be the kind of the way that he plays the game. He can show up every once in a while, but most of the time he just doesn't really come through.
Yeah, particularly in the big moments he doesn't come through.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, missing A.J. Green, big deal. But in the end, if you're going to be a winning quarterback, if you're going to be a top-tier quarterback, you've got to find people to throw the ball to, and that's what the good quarterbacks do.
So going over to the other AFC game and looking forward to next week, I know that you're a close follower and write a lot of articles about the New England Patriots. Do you have any inkling in how that game is going to go next week with the Ravens and Patriots? Third meeting between these two teams in four playoff seasons.
Well, my short answer is Patriots all the way. But, I mean, when you get down to specifics, you know, you've got an all-pro quarterback in Tom Brady. They got home field advantage. They have beaten pretty much all the best teams except for the one little faux pas with Green Bay. But other than that, they embarrassed Manning and the Broncos, Luck and the Colts. They beat the Bengals. I got to admit that actually out of the scenario that was that could have happened, I was most worried about the Ravens-Steelers game and who would come out of that. But, you know, if the Patriots can kind of control the front line and keep Brady upright, that's the biggest concern. But that's the only thing that'll beat him, I think, is a failure to stop that pass rush.
Yeah, I think that's what beat the Steelers. Big Ben sacked five times on Saturday night, and it's interesting that the Steelers-Ravens game caught your eye, because after the Ravens had won and dominated the Steelers, and we knew they were going to play the Patriots, I just started thinking, like, this is probably maybe the one team New England doesn't want to play of the other five that were in the playoffs in the AFC.
Well, I think that's true. And you know, obviously Belichick, you know, once that game is over with, says, okay, here's what we got to do to beat the Ravens. So all week, what are they going to be doing? Is they're going to be talking about how to keep those pass rushers out of Tom Brady's face. The other part of that is they're going to have something that beats a blitz. And what beats a blitz better than either the run game or screen passes? And they've been able to do that fairly successfully all year. Granted, their running game, not what it once was, but they've got Jonas Gray, they've got LeGarrette Blount. If both of those guys play, they definitely have enough of a running threat to counteract that blitz.
I would say Rob Gronkowski is a pretty good target with the blitz coming, too.
Well, yeah, and he can get downfield pretty fast for a big guy, so that helps.
Right, yeah. We're talking football AFC playoffs with FN senior writer Doug Tozer. Doug, do you have a prediction for the rest of the playoffs going forward? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but do you have a Super Bowl pick?
Obviously, as a Patriots fan for life and writing mostly about the Patriots, I'd have to, you know, say the Patriots. But what I kind of wonder is who's really going to take control of the NFC. I mean, Dallas looked pretty good, but that's against the Lions, and they've struggled. You got the Packers, you've got Seattle, who looked really good down the stretch. You know, I'd like to see Seattle get there and the Patriots beat them and show that they really are the king of the Super Bowl. But, you know, I got to say, from the AFC, I think the Patriots have a hard road. No matter who they face, the Ravens, the winner of the Broncos-Colts game, and, you know, no matter what, it's going to be a rough road, and just got to say, it might take a little bit of luck to... Oh, that's the wrong word to use. You know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, it will certainly be an interesting few weeks, as it always is in January, but this year in particular, it seems like there are three or four or five teams of the eight still left that could legitimately be the Super Bowl champion.
I think it's a great year, and we got some great teams in there. My final prediction, Patriots over Seahawks, 27-24.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Doug, for coming on today's show.
I appreciate you having me, Dave. I'll talk to you later.
Doug can be followed on Twitter at Tozer Patriot. Tozer spelled T-O-Z-I-E-R. Another song from Cheap Trick. When we come back, we'll have a abbreviated fourth and long segment. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. Your host, Dave Holcomb. Don't forget, I want to hear from you guys. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. Or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. We're running short on time here, so we're going to go quickly to our fourth and long segment. Just two statements. One, going back to the Cowboys and Lions game, talking about the referees and the controversial call. I don't want to talk about the call again, but I want to talk about something that the NFL has been doing, I think, for the last couple of years, and that is with their referees and how they choose them for the playoffs. I wasn't able to find anything online that would explain how they choose their referees for playoff games. If somebody out there can find an article or knows exactly how the NFL chooses their playoff referees, please get a hold of me. I'd love to read a story about it. But they talked about this at the beginning of the Fox game of Dallas and Detroit on Fox Sunday evening, that Pete Morelli is the head official. He was the head official of that NFC wildcard game, but he didn't have his normal crew. The other members of the crew were other quote-unquote all-stars through the entire season. And the way that Fox explained it was that they weren't even really the all-stars. The all-stars don't come into effect in the playoffs until the championship and Super Bowl weekend. So I'm not sure if these guys were the B team all-stars or what, but it was not Pete Morelli with his normal crew, and that's what I want the focus of this discussion to be. And my statement, the NFL should have officials, the officiating teams for the wild card and division round, they should have teams paired up that have worked with each other all season long. Absolutely. I'm grunting on that. I don't understand why the NFL would want a bunch of referees that haven't worked together before working such an important game like a wild card weekend game, a wild card game between the Cowboys and Lions. We'll never know for sure, but that could have indirectly led to picking up the flag, the pass interference no call, that really hurt the Lions' chances of winning that game. Who knows? Maybe one ref wasn't as confident in his call. Maybe the ref that threw the flag wasn't confident. Maybe somebody else came in and convinced them to pick it up. Somebody that he just met that week. I don't know how often other referees that don't work with each other interact. It's just a really bad idea. And it's just the things that they do with some of these referees. I mean, the lockout from the referees a few years ago. And now this idea of not having the same teams work together in the playoffs is just absurd to me. The stuff that they do with the referees is stupid. We talk about all the time. All the time we complain about bad calls, bad calls. The referees, I give them credit. They get a lot of calls right. They get a lot of things right. And it's a very hard job. But why do you make it harder on them by having them work with people they've never worked with before? How about we have a free agency fantasy draft before the playoffs and we'll pair Tony Romo with Jordy Nelson and his center can be Marquise Pouncey and his tight end can be Rob Gronkowski. It's just, that's absurd. Everybody that I just heard that me just suggest that is laughing at me. That's what they do with the referees. That's what they have to go through. My last statement here today, we're talking about a team not in the playoffs. The Buffalo Bills have been making headlines with their squabbling. I mean, that's really what's going on there. The front office squabbling, and it has led to the departure of head coach Doug Marrone. Marrone had in his contract 3 days to opt out of his 3-year contract. He just finished year two. It was written in his contract that he could opt out 3 days after the regular season because of ownership change. That's why the old owner wrote in that clause for him, and he decided to step away. He's guaranteed $4 million this season, and he can go find work wherever he wants for the 2015 season. Pretty good deal to get paid, and then also go find whatever job you want. I've been reading now that apparently if the Bills fired Marrone, he was due $8 million. So it was actually maybe in the Bills' best interest to let Marrone walk. Now, and if you wanted Marrone out, it was in the Bills' best interest to let him walk. But I'm still kind of puzzled as why they wanted Marrone out. Buffalo had not had a winning season before this year since 2004. So it's been 10 years. Finally, they break through and win 9 games. And the first thing that happens this offseason is they let their head coach go. Apparently, Marrone went to ownership and asked for his own contract extension. He also asked for contract extensions for his assistant coaches. I read this in various places, and I also talked to an FN writer on Twitter, Jeff Hunter. He read the same thing in various places. The ownership denied that. I don't understand why the ownership would deny him a contract extension when he's the first coach that got you to a winning season in 10 years. Now it comes out over the weekend that apparently Doug Marrone left the draft room last spring when the Bills traded up to pick Sammy Watkins. That was reported by ESPN's Adam Schefter. I see both sides of that, because when that trade happened last spring, I did not think that was a good move. If you are a big fan of Football Nation and you follow Kerry Burns's, any of his work at Cold Hard Football Facts, wide receiver is the position you take when you have everything else in place. I know Buffalo just took a quarterback last year, and I know Buffalo's defense was very good this season, so maybe they didn't necessarily need another defensive player, but they have other needs that they probably could have addressed. They only had 9 wins this year. Don't tell me that they had to trade up to get this wide receiver, Sammy Watkins, especially when if you had good scouting, you could have realized that there were a lot of good wide receivers. It was a very deep draft. You could have picked Odell Beckham at number 9 if you stood at 9 and you didn't have to give up the first round draft pick for this year. Instead, you trade up and get Sammy Watkins. I'm not saying Sammy Watkins won't be as good in the long run as Odell Beckham, but I'm just saying in terms of value, you could have had Beckham and a first-round pick this season instead of just Sammy Watkins. So I understand Doug Marrone's grief there, but there's also a story on football on NBC's Pro Football Talk that Marrone is just a control freak. Now, this article quotes a lot of unnamed sources coming out of Buffalo, but they do not have nice things to say about Doug Marrone, saying that he's just a complete control freak. He's about power and control. He's a dangerous person to have inside the building is one of the quotes here, and he's a very average coach that doesn't connect well with players. There's a lot in that, and you know, I kind of see that as well. I went to Syracuse. Marrone coached all 4 years I was at Syracuse. Didn't think he was all that good at coaching there. He was the definition of average. The Orange went 25-25 while he was there. Of course, that was a lot better than what they went the previous 4 years before he came to Syracuse. They were awful. But this is kind of the same story with the Bills. You know, the Bills were awful, not a good team. And he steps in and he makes them mediocre. Not sure he's really that good of a head coach. Not sure that he really should be coveted as much as he seems to be by the New York Jets and perhaps the Atlanta Falcons as well. He is a guy that, to me, seems very selfish. And I know I haven't had a statement yet. Maybe I'm not going to. We're running short on time here. And all this, my points, see, I'm making all the points that I wanted to, so I don't necessarily have to make a statement. But Marone, to me, he's in it all for himself. And maybe he didn't like the pick to get Watkins because it's going to hurt his team and hurt his reputation because he can't win. Maybe he doesn't seem to be a team player. He left Syracuse right when he was in the middle of building something, and he's leaving Buffalo right in the middle of building something as well. And I know a lot of his players went on Twitter and were really angry about Marone leaving. The other thing that's interesting, another wrench thrown into this story, it was reported even earlier this week that Bill Polian was a front runner to take over the front office job in Buffalo, and he has connections to the Bills. Turns out that Doug Marone went to Bill and really badmouthed the organization and encouraged him not to take the job. I saw that story on several different websites. I got mine specifically from Syracuse.com. So just, it's a really interesting story. It's he said, she said, he said, we said. It goes back and forth. It's hard to kind of go through the rubble and see who is right on this. Ultimately, I think both sides are wrong. Buffalo is being stupid for letting go a coach that got them above 500. And Marone isn't all that great of a coach, and I don't see why he is so coveted by the New York Jets. The rumors right now are that he is the front runner to take over that position. So it'll be an interesting month, not just with the playoffs, but with all of the coaching carousel moves and offseason changes coming up in the next 3 to 4 weeks or so. And we'll keep you up to date with all of it here on Monday Morning Huddle. One more song from Cheap Trick, and then we'll come back and wrap up today's show. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. Your host, Dave Holcomb. I want to thank our guests for coming on the show one more time. Next week, we already have a couple of guests lined up for you guys. John Garces is going to come on the show, a longtime Football Nation writer, and our friend Chad Johnson. He is a Bengals expert, lives out there in Cincinnati. I'm hoping to get the scoop on the Bengals from him a little bit more in depth than we went in with Doug Tozer. Hopefully, Chad still wants to come on the show, even though the Bengals ended up losing. So hopefully we get Chad on and also John Garces, who's going to help us recap the Cowboys and Packers next week. Look out for Tom Pollen's Autopsy of an Upset article. I'm assuming he's still going to write that for the playoffs. There was only one upset this weekend, so I'm pretty sure he's going to be writing about the Steelers and Ravens. I'm looking forward to how he breaks down that one. The last item on today's show, anybody who's watched ESPN the last 15, 20 years, and I mean anything on ESPN, whether it's SportsCenter, Monday Night Countdown, Sunday Night Countdown, Stump the Schwab. Remember that show? Stump the Schwab, one of my favorite shows to watch if I was homesick in the afternoon. Stuart Scott was the host of that show and so many other shows on ESPN. And we heard the very sad news Sunday morning that Stuart Scott had passed away at the age of 49. I just wanted to send our condolences to Stuart Scott's family here from our family here at Football Nation. He will be missed as a pioneer in this sports media world. He really did some very unique things, and I won't be able to say a tribute to him as well as some of the tributes that came from his colleagues at ESPN, and in particular, the one that I recommend everybody going out to check out, the one from Rich Eisen. He was a co-anchor with Stewart in the mid-90s at ESPN. I remember growing up with Stewart Scott and Rich Eisen on ESPN. anchoring SportsCenter. Well, Eisen has gone on to work for NFL Network, but Sunday morning he had a great 2 to 3 minute tribute for Stuart Scott. And for anybody that loves Stuart Scott or just is a big sports fan, should go check out Eisen's tribute to Scott. You can probably find it on Twitter or just Google it. It's pretty much everywhere on the web. That's all we have for today's show. Until next week, I'm going to go try and find some peace in my mind.